All right. Welcome, everybody. My name is Jeff Higgins. This is my wife, Cynthia's, in my restaurant. We are recording this for a podcast for later use. Thank you for coming. We appreciate it. And thank you for eating. It's nice to see everybody keeping us in business while we do this. I'm glad you're enjoying it. It's based on my wife's family recipes from Alexandria, Egypt. So a lot of these go back. She has Pharaonic roots in her family, so they go back a long time. Really appreciate you being here. We've turned Elaine's into a literary salon. I think you are now the 124th author that I've interviewed since we've opened a couple of years ago. And so we give free space for authors. So if you are a writer or you know a writer, let them know about us. We're happy to support them in any way we can. It's become a real hub for the literary community in Northern Virginia and the D.C. area. I'm also an ambassador for the Authors Guild, and we're hosting lots of events for them as well. Excited about this one today. It's interesting. I'm looking forward to talking to you. Sarah DeBlock is the founder of the Soma Yoga Healing Center in Alexandria, Virginia, where she helps people thrive and reconnect with their inner joy. A lifelong student, she brings deep insight and compassion to her healing work, guiding others on their path to well-being through the intersection of self-discovery and community. She's a best-selling author of The Year of Sarah, a memoir about love, loss, and finding oneself through life's unexpected turns. Sarah discovered yoga in 2011 while studying chemical engineering. That's interesting. Amid academic pressure, yoga became her anchor. In 2015, she experienced its healing power firsthand when teachers at Rasa Yoga helped her recover from 5 years of sciatica. That transformation inspired her to study yoga therapy, not just for her own growth, but to share its life-changing benefits with others. So please welcome Sarah DeBlock. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited.
Yeah, me too. So first off, congratulations on the book. It's a really big deal to write a book. I have so many writers in here, and it's interesting because people come in all the time and they say, oh, I write a book, and everybody wants to write a book. But when they actually get started, the number of people who say they want to and then start is like 3%. And then 1% of them actually ever finish a book. And I won't terrify you with the numbers on actually getting a book published. But the numbers are ridiculously low. So congratulations. It's a really big accomplishment.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
So why don't you start and tell everybody just in general, what is the book about?
Yeah. So The Year of Sarah is a memoir about a chapter in my life after graduating college and a decision I had made where I didn't follow my heart led my boyfriend there, then now husband, to be apart. And I was really heartbroken by this and heartbroken by not following my inner voice. And so I ended up moving states, being in a very demanding job. We were planning our wedding, and I was just really not happy with where my life was. And I ended up finding yoga. And my yoga teacher said, I know this isn't what you wanted, but if you're going to be here for this year, make it the year of Sarah. And this story is about how I healed from this heartbreak and how yoga really showed me a new perspective. And really what I learned was I wasn't heartbroken from the separation from my love, but from myself, that I had separated from myself.
Was that a teacher, the one who wrote the introduction to this book?
It is, yeah, Padma Shakti.
That's really wonderful. Did writing the book itself help you in any way? Like, why did you want to write the book?
Yeah. So, you know, we already mentioned my yoga guru, Padma. She actually suggested that I write the book because she watched me over those 5 years and watched me grow and said a lot of people are going through what you did and you should share it. So my initial reason was I'm going to write this book so that if someone can suffer less than I did going through something similar, that they don't have to suffer like I did. But what did surprise me about writing the book is how much I healed from it. Like, I didn't really understand how much it was going to support me, but really having to process and think about 5 years of your life and write down what happened and what you learned from it. At the end of writing the book, I realized like I have no more regrets from that chapter in my life. Like,
so was it like a catharsis by just getting it on paper?
Yeah, getting it on paper. And I think really being able to see how everything connected and the intricacy of how it all came together for really my husband and me, even though it's mostly about me in the book, of how it helped both of us live a better life in the end.
What is it about writing? And does it make you more introspective by having to sit there and actually like articulate every single thing that you're feeling?
Yeah, definitely. Because you can have a feeling, but then you have to put it into words, and then you actually got to have a sentence and create conclusion based off it. And so I do think, you know, and as a yogi, I've always been introspective naturally. And I've normally done it through meditation or reflection, but there is something very powerful about actually needing to put a word on a paper and write it that is extremely healing and forces you to think even deeper.
Did you write on a computer or did you write this with a pen?
I wish I could say pen because I think that's more healing, but I did do computer just since it is so many words. And I wrote it in a big Google Doc. There's actually one funny story. So you mentioned how a lot of people never actually get to the end of their book and, you know, the 3% and the 1%. Well, I did the whole thing on Google Docs thinking, well, Google Drive's really safe. Like, I trust their servers. Like, it'll always be there. Yeah. And then one day, you know, I got a notice that my Google Drive was 99% full and I was really careful just deleting photos. My book was not even in my mind at this point. I was just like, I need to use my email. So I was like deleting all these photos. Well, 2 days later, I went to write my book and I had just finished the first draft. Like, first draft just finished. So proud of myself. The whole thing's gone. Like, I don't know how, but somehow I had deleted it. And I was like, if this is gone forever, I don't know if I'm going to rewrite it. Like, this book may never, you know, see the light of day. But my husband jumped in and he's like, okay, just go out of the room, do something. And he like called Google and chatted them. And somehow 48 hours later, he got it back.
You're so lucky.
Yes.
That hasn't happened to me. By the way, just about every writer I've spoken to has lost a manuscript at some point.
Oh,
like, in the longer you write, the more you write, people, you know, back it up. I back it up like 5 different ways, and some in the cloud, and some in Drive, and I email myself a copy every day. And I mean, it's brutal, right? It's a moment of terror.
It was a moment of terror, and so I absolutely have 20 copies of everything now, and I learned my lesson. And so any author listening to this who's maybe starting the journey, save copies.
Even having the going old school, right, with a paper copy, and just having it in the first case, and then you've got it there.
Exactly.
Unless your house is down.
Exactly. Print it out.
So let's talk about the themes of the book a little bit. So tell us about the trauma that started this whole thing off.
Yeah, so I was studying chemical engineering in school, and my husband was studying material science engineering. And kind of late in our college career, he decided he needed to get a PhD to really do the work he wanted to do. But that meant I needed to choose where I was going to work in the fall, and he would not choose where he, he wouldn't know where he got into school until the spring. And so I had to choose between two different jobs, and I chose the one that we thought, well, logically, it really seemed like foolproof, like we'll definitely be able to both be in Houston, even if that didn't work, so it was between Houston and LA, and just all the facts lined up that absolutely, we should go to Houston. This is going to work. We'll, you know, financially be better off and we'll be together. And my heart, though, wanted to go to California. Like, I just deep in my gut knew I want to go to California. That's where a lot of yoga is. I want to be on the beaches and the sun. But I didn't follow my heart. I followed logic. And in the end, he ended up in LA and I was in Houston. And so that was really the heartbreak that after college, so we're high school sweethearts. I don't think I mentioned that either. So we'd already been together 8 years, but all through it was high school and college. And I was ready to like finally be adults and start our life without school. And we went our own separate ways to LA and Houston. And that was really hard for me.
You met 7th grade, right?
I wish I could say that for age, but no, we met at 15 years. Well, we met at 14 years old, freshman year of high school. And we started dating sophomore year of high school.
Do you want to tell everybody how you first met?
Sure. Well, actually, there's a little section in the book about it. But the very first time my husband ever saw me, it was the very first day of freshman year of high school. And my neighbor had taught me how to take a shortcut through the school. And she said, only upperclassmen know how to do this shortcut. So I thought, I'm going to be really cool with my friend to do this shortcut. Well, we ended up on the wrong side of school. And so we had to run all the way across school to get. And so I run into German class late. So my husband's in this class sitting there. And me and my friend run. Like, I mean, we're sprinting into the store, giggling. By this point, we're like full on hysterical laughing at ourselves, completely interrupt class. And that's the first time my husband ever saw me. So luckily, I recovered from that first impression. But we did meet in German class in freshman year of high school.
And how long were you separated when you were in Houston, he was in California?
It turned into 5 years.
Wow. How often did you see each other during that 5-year period?
We did our best to see each other once a month. Yes.
So I'm sure a lot of people have long distance relationships, but what are the challenges in those in long distance?
Yeah. I mean, one challenge is that you have to actually travel to each other. And so, you know, and also one of my goals was to not travel a lot after college. I know it's like the opposite of what most people do, but my mom travels a lot for her job, and she had been, you know, generous to let me travel the world with her when I was a kid. And so I really wanted to travel for fun, but not for work. And so it takes a lot of time to fly to each other and make that commitment. And so, like, a lot of your, you know, as an adult, your weekends are normally already scheduled, and, you know, there's only so much time on the weekends to do all the fun things you want, but then you have to actually take, like, a lot of weekends out of your time just to see each other and to just connect on a daily basis. Like, I think the struggle is, yes, you can call each other, yes, you can Zoom. Like, we're so fortunate to be in a day of technology, but there's something different about just being able to casually say a comment together in a room that you think of, or to get a hug, or to get that kiss on the forehead at the end of the day. And it feels separate, and you don't get to share your memories together.
Were there times in that five-year period, which is a really long time to be apart, when you just were like, I'm quitting and go, I'm gonna fly and see him?
Yes. There were those moments, but I never did that. I never, like, on the spot got on a plane and did it. But there was a very, and it's in the book, this part, I call it my second heartbreak. There was a moment, I think it was about a year and a half in, where I said, okay, I'm absolutely done with this. I'm going to get a job in Los Angeles. And I started looking at jobs. I did my whole resume, and I was job searching. And, you know, my husband called me and said, I really think you should stay in Houston. It looks like I'm going to be getting an internship in Japan, and then I'm going to have an internship in D.C. And he said, even if you come here to L.A., I don't think I'm going to be here, or I won't be here a lot. And I, you know, right now you're not finding dream jobs in L.A., and so I'm nervous that you're going to leave this life that you've created that's really great in Houston and not get to be here. And so we had a hard conversation and decided that at that time it made sense for me to stay in Houston until he graduated.
At any point during that time, did you feel like this wasn't going to work out, the relationship, because it was so difficult?
No, luckily I didn't have that. I do think some long-distance relationships have that struggle, but I was fortunate that I think my husband and I have known since almost day one when we met each other that we'll definitely be together and our love is here to stay. But it was just heartbreaking to not, you know, be able to see each other.
So when people get together at that young of an age, say 10, 11, because people change a lot, right? When you guys met, your brains weren't even fully formed, right? So people tend to change, but they grow together because they're with each other.
Yeah.
How about when you're separated like that? You continue to change and grow as a person, right? Do you feel like it's less in sync because you're not, you know, geographically in proximity?
I think in our case, it was beneficial for us to have that time to grow apart. So I think the reason the heartbreak was so strong was because we had become adults together. Like, you know, from 15 years old when we were just kids, like, we had been in all the same educational classes. We had lived in the same geographical area. We had formed our beliefs, our ethics all together, and we really supported each other. So when we separated, it was almost like this, I say in the book, like an emotional blanket was like ripped out, like it, because we were so always supporting each other, so alike. And so that time apart, since we had met so young, actually gave us that chance to be like, well, what is my actual passion? What is, like, maybe I'll form a belief that's different than you. And I just think that it was really helpful for us to be able to actually create our own life separately for a while. And it ended up having us come back stronger. You know, I think for some, maybe that would separate, but for us, I think it benefited us to come back and be able to say, like, oh, I discovered this and you discovered that, and then we can talk about it.
So when people, you know, two people compliment each other, right? They bring things to a relationship that the other one doesn't have. How do you draw, like, a line between that and then your identity as a couple, right? Where you see yourself together and how you define yourself versus that individual identity.
You mean, like, how do we do it now or, like, back then?
Both.
Yeah. So there was a point in our life where we did not have a good boundary. So especially in high school, people started seeing us as one person. And, you know, someone might just text one of us about plans, but not both, because people saw us as, like, one, you know, unit. And so in college, we actually, like, worked on setting boundaries. Like, we're two separate people. You know, if you need to contact both of us separately. And we even, like, started creating our own hobbies and you know, we actually thought we had done a really good job. We had found a way to be a really strong couple and have our own things. But then during this long distance relationship, I think it shined a light on where there was more work to do there. And so I think I don't have like a one way you do that, but I do think it's important as a couple to always be aware of both and to know that together you're really strong and to let people know like, oh, yes, we are this power couple, but at the same time, you know, this person does this thing and this person does that. And one way we do it now is like we both do have our own dreams and goals, and we don't really worry about normal societal, I guess, expectations or rules. Like even today, right now, my husband is coaching rock climbing and I support his dream while I'm doing this dream. And it's okay that we're both doing something different on a Saturday.
And how is that like flying in the face of convention?
You mean emotionally?
I mean, you know, you said the societal norms or whatever, but, you know, it seems rock climbing and people do that. It's just because it's a, these are different hobbies or different things that you're doing it just for yourselves or
oh, yeah.
What do you get from it?
Well, that we're doing it for ourselves and that we do work a lot of nights and weekends and just don't worry about what's normal or what's not. Just, I guess, trying to follow our hearts now, listening to what we really want to do and following our heart. Versus maybe what we were told we should do.
So my wife always said, like, when she has high standards with friends and people she dated, and it was always, like, making herself the person that would attract the person that she actually wants. Did that time apart make you round you out in a way that you think is way better for your husband and vice versa?
Yeah, because I'm able to listen to my heart more now on what I really want, and he can see that I'm happier now. And so I think anytime your partner is happier, that's going to be better for the couple. And, you know, back then I was working up the ladder to a career that wasn't really my passion. And I was able to learn how to stand on my own and listen into what I really want and take the leap of faith, even though I had fear, to do what I really want. And he's much happier seeing me happy.
So let's talk about that you had this career that wasn't your passion. I mean, careers, obviously, people work for money to live, right, which can benefit them in a lot of ways. How do you draw the line between something that, like, develops human capital, something that's marketable, they can bring in the money, versus something that you're passionate about?
Yeah, there definitely has to be a balance. And so when my journey, I did it gradually. So I know a lot of people, they get their dream and they maybe just like radically take a leap of faith. And I'm so impressed by them. But that's not how we did it. So we, I guess we're quite logical on how we did it. But when my husband was getting his PhD, he wasn't really making money. So I made the money as chemical engineer in those 5 years. And we always said once he graduated and got a job with his doctorate, that then I would open my yoga studio. So in a way, we supported each other's dreams financially. And even when I opened my yoga studio, I did part-time engineering for the first year. And so we really thought about how do we step up to this dream and make sure that we're not, you know, financially or logistically going to be in trouble.
And the engineering that came from your parents, right?
They are both engineers, yes. And I really had no idea what I wanted to major in college. And I think that's because I had not discovered yoga at that time. So I hadn't even discovered what I want and didn't know it existed. And they, you know, I was really strong in chemistry and math in school. And they said, hey, I think this might be in your genes. But even if that's not for you, they said an engineering degree will let you do any job. Like, you don't have to just be an engineer with that degree. And so that's why I majored in that.
I've spoken to so many writers, you know, who were told early on by parents, that's great that you're writing your little stories, but you can't possibly make money on it. So go do something to earn. Like I would say most writers, right? At some point you were driven down one thing. But so now you're doing multiple things that you're passionate about, right? Is the writing itself, is that something that brings you, is that a passion?
When I look back now to my childhood, I think it was, but it is not something that I have been doing. Like I remember being in third grade and just writing poems like all day on a Saturday. And I remember bringing this huge stack of construction paper with poems on it to my mom and being like, look at all these poems I wrote. But then I didn't continue that. I got really focused on, you know, science and math and athletics. And I believe writing this book reminded me of that passion.
How old were you when you were writing these poems?
That was like third grade.
Okay, so if you're writing stacks of poems in third grade, you're a writer. I don't want to be the first one to break this to you, but that's a storytelling gene or need that's within you. So that's good. So, but yoga's your other passion. So, like, I have questions about this. Like, what types of yoga are there? Right, there are many different types.
Yeah, there are many different actual lineages of yoga, and then in this day and age, there's many branded yogas, which aren't necessarily different yogas, but, you know, we have businesses these days and like to make money, so we also have branded names. But there's, in general, you know, all of yoga has eight limbs. So there's the postures, which is what we're most familiar with, and that's really where you'll hear a lot of differentiation, like Ashtanga or Dharma, Vinyasa, Hatha, Kundalini. But then, you know, you've got meditation and pranayama and even pratyahara, which almost no one ever talks about, which is withdrawal of the senses. So there's many different tools in yoga and many different paths.
And which one do you practice?
So I do practice all eight limbs, which is called like Raja Yoga, the eight limbs. But for the asana, mostly Hatha and Vinyasa Yoga.
So when you're doing, like you mentioned, like a mindfulness, right? Like how does, because, you know, explain the difference between yoga and meditation.
Yeah.
How do they come together?
Okay. I love that question. Because in modern society, to be able to talk about it, we've split the words yoga and meditation. But really, yoga is meditation. So of the eight limbs of yoga, three of them are meditation, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. And so, you know, like if you go to India and someone says like, oh, do you do yoga? They're actually thinking meditation. They're probably more likely going to visualize someone sitting and meditating. But in America, if you said, do you do yoga? People are more likely going to visualize like doing a flexible pose. So yoga and meditation are really one. But the word yoga just means union, and it's really a state of consciousness to bring your mind into a place of one-pointed thought and to reduce our thoughts. And you can do that through postures or through sitting or visualizing. So there are different tools all within yoga on how to still our mind.
So I guess they're both forms of like intense focus, right?
Yes.
So how do you do that intense focus where you're clearing your mind, and you're being more mindful while you're like in motion? Like, is it holding a pose that does it or not, but not in between poses? I'm just curious how that works.
It's both. The transitions are just as important as when you're in the pose. And it takes a lot of training, but it's really through breath first. So, you know, to just move your body is one thing, but if you're intentionally moving it with your breath, or if the mind's really running, you could even add a mantra in there. And it's that every time a thought comes, to like catch it, but not attach to it, let it flip by and come back to your breath. So that eventually the brain is trained, like we're continually coming back to breath, return, as many times as it takes to learn it.
How were you introduced to yoga?
Yeah, one of my college roommates was like, hey, do you want to go to this yoga class with me? And engineering is very male dominated. So I thought, yeah, I need some more girl time. So let's go to this yoga class, see what it's about. And it was an extremely stressful semester. My heart rate had been escalated like the whole semester. Like I could feel it and I knew it wasn't a good level of stress. And when I did this yoga class, which was really just at the college gym, it was nothing fancy or, you know, upscale at all, or even an advanced yoga teacher, I felt my heart rate go down. And for that whole hour, my heart rate was normal. And I thought, I need to learn more about this. If that can affect me that much in an hour, there's something here.
When I first like meditated, I was shocked at what my mind was doing without my knowledge, right? So consciously like running reels in my head. Like, I think, well, when did you first notice that? Because I think it's a common thing for everybody.
Yeah, actually, I think a funny story on that, but my college also had a meditation group that you could go to, and they actually brought in monks from Chicago who, you know, meditated like their whole life. And so they would teach us to meditate on Wednesday nights. And one day I told one of the monks, my mind just runs the whole time. Like it's just thoughts. Like I'm not doing what you asked me to. I can't stop these thoughts. And he looked at me and he just said, that's because you're a newbie. And at the time, you know, I wanted to be seen as like, wow, she's so skilled and like really sitting here and doing it. And I was like, I don't want to be a newbie. But now that I've meditated for years, I can absolutely say he was correct. I was just a newbie and learning in that moment that my mind was running rampant and I didn't have mastery over it.
It's why they call it a meditative practice, right? Yes. Like, I mean, it's amazing how difficult it is. Same thing with yoga. I think people who have done yoga think of it in a different way than when you actually try it and see how really challenging it can be.
Yeah, and it really is a practice. There is something strange about when people come to yoga that I think they feel a pressure to be able to keep up with everything the teacher is cueing, and this feeling of like, well, everyone's in this class together and I've got to do this pose. But like when people sign up for a piano class or they sign up for, I don't know, a painting class, I don't think they walk in expecting to like play the concerto or, you know, to get the perfect image. But I do think we put a pressure on ourselves when we go to a yoga class that we're supposed to do it. And so I do think, you know, it's really helpful to realize like it is a practice that takes years to learn and don't expect yourself to, you know, get it on the first class.
I mean, the same could be said about writing, right? Yes. Everyone reads, everyone writes emails or whatever. And, but then when you're writing a book, it's very different. How did you, I mean, I think they say a million words somewhere, right? A million words before you really hit your stride. How did you teach yourself to write?
Well, that's a great question. So I can say it was probably more self-taught in the beginning. You know, it's now that I've published this book, the really neat thing is a lot of people have been inspired to write a book, and I've been getting a lot of messages. I signed up for a writing course. I'm doing this. I'm learning. And I was like, I didn't think to do that. I just started writing. Like, I didn't think to get a teacher. But really, yeah, just like writing. So I did read one thing online that said, don't edit while you're writing your first draft. It said, just write, and you can always edit later. So that's really what I did, is I just kept writing and kept writing, and then, of course, lots of editing. And then in the end, I did with my publisher. That is where we refined. So I think I learned by just writing and then reading out loud and seeing when I read out loud which parts sounded good and which sounded really awkward and moving that way. But my publisher was amazing in the developmental editing of teaching me how to really show it, you know, through visuals versus just telling, and how to think through what should the flow be and how to have a thread throughout. And the most important thing I think she did for me in the memoir perspective is show me what parts of me I didn't have on paper. It's kind of like when you tell a fish about water and they're like, what is water? The memoir can be a little bit like that. Like there were parts of my personality that I hadn't realized I didn't put on the paper, and she was able to see that, which was also really helpful for me in learning to write, of like, oh, yeah, what does the reader not know that I am so accustomed to that I'm assuming they know?
What were the other mistakes that, you know, you think, because everyone makes the same mistakes. I still make all the mistakes, right? So what were the early things when you first started writing that now you know are wrong, that you as a writer?
Well, a really major one, and this caused a lot of editing, but I'm glad for the ability to edit and think through it, is in the beginning, I actually thought my book was about a long-distance relationship. And really what it's about is personal growth that was forced through the long distance relationship. And so I think from the get-go, I wasn't clear enough on what it's really about. And so I think before writing, like the clearer you can get on what it's really about, then you're going to be able to really hone in on that and get the message across stronger. But as a former engineer, what I did is a little bit tell too many things. I was giving too much detail and telling things that people didn't need to know, and I needed to get deeper into the emotional and the lessons part of it versus, you know, the details of the story. And that was definitely a thing I learned. So my editor helped me be like, these details aren't going to mean anything else to other people, but they do care how you reacted to it and things like that.
Yeah, it's all about the emotion, right? Because you're trying to get it out of the reader.
Yeah.
And it's also like you have to look at yourself as a character in the book. And it is, you know, it is an arc. Like there has to – so what was your arc? Like where did you start either emotionally or intellectually, and where did you end?
Yeah, the arc ended up being like the healing journey. So it's we made the arc like first is like breaking, like, you know, this phase of like kind of my emotional nervous system shattering. And then it goes into like feeling the pain of it, like actually being in it and – living it, and then it comes into like starting to heal and being healed. So it's kind of through the heartbreak is what we made the main theme of the book, moving through that
heart. If you could go back and talk to yourself at the beginning of that separation, what would you have told yourself?
I would have told myself it's okay to take the time you need and to focus on yourself for a little bit. One thing I would do now if I was there is just take a break from my job for a month. I think at that time, especially being in such a high pressure corporate world, that felt like my career would be over if I asked for that time. But what I really needed to do was take a month off my job, get my wedding in order, get my health in order, and then go back and be strong. But instead, I just did everything. We haven't mentioned this yet, but my health did get impacted, and I did get sick from all the stress and the heartbreak. And it would have just been so much better to take time off and take care of myself instead of pushing through it all.
So stress is a killer, right? Yes. What are signs if people are going through what you're going through now that they should be looking for?
Yeah. Heartburn, fatigue, heart rate increasing, learning news and maybe overreacting. That if you were in a positive place that you would be able to think through that and internalize it. But when you're stressed, it's do tears surface right away when someone says something, or anger, that might mean that our nervous system has been overworked, burnout, and really any weird kind of digestive issues. I think digestive issues are a really clear sign that our nervous system is upset.
And what would the solution be?
There are many ways to heal, but for me, it was yoga and getting back into my body. I was a very analytical person, and I was really in my head, and yoga helped me get back into my body and to be more embodied and notice my breath and notice my emotions and honor all of that. But also just finding someone who's supportive of you, that could be step one, finding someone who can guide you and help you. Finding a teacher for me was also a big step. I got a yoga teacher who really helped me. Staying with your breath, getting out in nature, and believing that you can take the time to do what you need and things aren't going to fall apart. I think sometimes we're afraid that, if we don't get everything perfect, if we don't get that full to-do list right, if we don't, maybe we've got family members we need to take care of, or you've got, a team at work. But just knowing, if you step away for a moment, the world won't crumble. It will all work out, and it'll work out better because you'll then be stronger to handle all those things that you want to do.
You mentioned getting out in nature. What is it about getting out in nature that's calming?
So many things. Just getting off our devices is really important. Being on phones and devices, for one, it depends what you're doing on them. But, if you're on social media, you're only seeing, all the good things of people's life, or maybe trauma in the news. I also do Ayurveda. And so our devices are considered air and ether as elements. And so they get us really in our head, and they get us really in our thoughts, and they make our thoughts spin even more than, most of us don't need help with that. Our thoughts are already spinning. But when you get out in nature, especially if your feet are on the ground, then you're bringing more grounding and earth element into your life. And it separates you from your environment. Just changing your environment and being somewhere where you feel the breeze on your skin, similar to yoga, though. Yoga poses get us back into our body, but if you're feeling the breeze on your skin, you're feeling the sun on your skin, that's going to help you start to get back in your body as well and draw back to your heart and less in the mind. And I just think hearing the sounds of nature and the trees, we are nature ourselves. We forget that, but we are not separate from nature. And so we're kind of seeing ourselves reflected back to us. We're seeing our true nature of peace and serenity reflected back to us.
Did you know, when you say you're an analytical person, did you notice a difference in your thought processes, not just a reduced stress level, but when you got off your device and you're relaxing and you're getting out in nature and kind of clearing your mind in those ways, how did that affect the way you approach things?
I pause before just jumping into something. I create more space between the whatever event happens that causes me to think, there's space between that and the thinking and the reacting. But it also brought more creativity. When your mind is spinning too fast, there's no space for those creative epiphanies or those aha moments. And so when I stilled my mind, I could still be analytical when I wanted to, but there was a lot more space for creative solutions and better solutions than I would have thought of if I had just been, trying to rush through analytically at like A to B, and then what's the solution and how do you, like, that creates no space for a new solution to arise.
So since we all fill up our dead space with like being on the phone or listening to something or doing something, people don't have that board time, right? Yeah. Is that, as a storyteller, did you feel like when you give yourself that time that you new ideas would come into your mind?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been asked a lot, how long did it take you to write this book or make this book? And it was a 4-year project. It by no means took that long to write it. There was a lot of gaps where I wasn't writing, but it was the moments of stillness where I would realize, oh, I forgot about that memory and I didn't write about that. And that was actually a really critical memory to the story. And so it was in the moments of silence that lessons would emerge, or a memory that I'd forgotten about, or even a creative way to write something. It would tend to be a little bit before bedtime, like in the stillness of night, like right before bedtime when I wasn't thinking, that some of my best writing ideas would come to me.
Do you find that there's been inventors who've done this and writers who've done it, but there's a quasi-sleep state, you know, right when you're about to drift off, when you first wake up in the morning before the external stimuli starts to interfere. Do you find that those are magical moments for you?
Definitely. And, you know, in yoga, they say those are the best times to meditate. And I do think that is a magical space. And there's also a practice called yoga nidra that helps you get to that spot, like even if it's not in that daytime or, you know, right at dawn or dusk. But yoga nidra is like trying to get yourself right before sleep without sleep. And it's, you know, been proven that that's our most creative brain state, and that helps bring our subconsciousness to the conscious. So I definitely noticed it in those times. And I also practice yoga nidra to try to expand my ability to get into that space, and it's really life-changing.
Do you know why that's a creative space for the brain? I'm just curious because I've heard it from a lot of writers, right? But, and I've experienced it myself, but do you know, like, neurologically what's going on?
So I can't remember the exact, so I know, like, when we're talking right now, we're in beta wavelength, and you have to get to like alpha, then theta, and then delta to sleep. So don't quote me, but I think yoga nidra is around the theta. And so it is something about those wavelengths of brain, that brain wavelength, that is where ideas arise. But just from yoga, what I know is that it helps our subconscious, like whatever's in our subconscious, come forward, which is why we'll kind of feel like we're dreaming. But it's like these thoughts, these memories are surfacing. But I don't know all of the science words.
It's interesting. No, yeah. And that's a great answer because, yeah. I mean, I had no idea, right? Yeah. But it's certainly a thing.
Yeah.
So you're writing memoir. That brings up like a writing script, but memoir is a different thing, different animal. When you're writing down these personal feelings or things, did you have some trepidation about sharing the stuff with a wide audience?
Yes, there were, I think talking about when I hit my lowest point, when I was sick and just like really fatigued and kind of hit rock bottom, that was hard to write about. But even writing the book, like, I forgive me, because I realized that's where I am now. So that, like, when I was writing that chapter, I was like, you know, looking back, it's kind of embarrassing thinking about where I was. But then I was like, but I didn't know any better back then. And the whole reason of writing the book is if someone else is there, I don't want them to suffer like I did. So I was like, I have to put it down in case someone else is in that position. And I was like, the only thing I can do is like see it in its entirety and forgive myself. And then writing about some of the things that happened in the corporate world, I talk a little bit about being in a male-dominated world as a female. And that was hard for me to write about. One, I just don't like writing negatively about someone. But also, you know, in the corporate world, it was a weird thing where I struggled a lot, but I also made some of my best friends that I've ever made. And that job did develop me. And so, you know, two things can be true. But I was worried when people read it that they would only hear the negative and be like, oh, was everything that she said was so great when I worked with her, you know, not real or not true? Because I think, you know, you just never know how people interpret it. But it was true that it was extremely hard and extremely beneficial for me.
I mean, I think it's the honesty, especially in the memoir, right? But it's if people can sense if you're whitewashing things, that they think it's, and you know, if you're just trying to be vindictive and something, people can sense that. But if you're not honest in the memoir, you know, there's no value to it.
Yeah.
And how much did you worry about these, well, other people, not necessarily the people at work, but just in general, what other people would think about you? I mean, was that inhibiting as you were writing?
At times it was, yeah. And what I decided to do was just write it exactly as it was and then reflect on that later. I decided, like, let me get the draft done and get it written. And then if I need to pull something back, I can do that later. I did pull something back temporarily, and then someone told me, you've got to put it back in. So it went back in the book. So they were like, no, just, like, be courageous, like, put it back in. But especially with family members and people who I'm super close with, I wondered about that. But I sent, anytime someone was in the book, even if I changed their name, I sent the chapter to them and had them read it, and I made sure everyone knew what was coming out before it came out.
Did you have anybody ask you to pull something?
No, I didn't. I had one person say it's really hard for me that you're putting this out there, but we were able to talk about it, and they never asked me to change it. And actually, one person, I had changed their name, thinking that they would definitely want that, and they told me to change it back to their real name. So that was a surprise.
So when you're putting this stuff out there, and then, you know, you do all this writing. Look, by the way, like, even fiction writers put a lot of themselves and their inner thoughts right into these things, and that always ends up being good stuff, you know. So I'm glad you did it like that. That was really smart, whether it's by chance or the plan. But when you finally get this out there, and then the book is published and it comes out, how scary is that?
It was scarier than I expected. I thought that when I published it, I had already processed all that. I think I thought, oh, I've already sent it to everyone I care about. And you know, you have a writing team, right? Or you have a launch team. So, like, the people who are closest to me had basically already read the book. And I thought, okay, they all reacted well. This is great. But then when I put it out there, a lot of people from my past jobs bought it. And a lot of people that I, or like family members, like real extended or people that I hadn't thought about. I was like, you know, you start seeing everyone who's buying it. And then I started second guessing myself, like, uh-oh, like, what am I going to think? But so, yeah, it did bring up fear, like, what's the reaction going to be? And actually, one person I used to work with who I adore, she sent me a message. She said, oh, my gosh, am I Alice in the book? And I thought, I can't, you know, and I was like, absolutely not. You know, like, you were one of my favorite people to work with. And then she never answered my message. Hmm. And I thought, but I think she was just busy. But it did make me wonder, you know, does she think she's that person? And that's absolutely not true. And so, like, moments like that, you just wonder, but you have to trust. And you just trust that your book is helping, you know, helping people and overall making a positive difference. And we don't get to decide how people interpret the world, the words. You know, I did it with the best intention and with a big heart, but I don't get to decide what people think of it.
I mean, it's impossible, right? Like, yeah. if you try to meet other people's expectations, or you try not to offend people, or whatever, it'll be like a book by a committee, and it'll be terrible. You know, and at the end, no matter what you write, someone's going to love it, someone's going to hate it. Have you had a 5-star review on this thing? So do you ever get negative comments, or do you read your reviews?
I do read the reviews. I have not really gotten negative comments, so that could just be that people aren't, you know, reaching out if they think that, but.
It's usually the opposite. It's the angry people who reach out first.
Yeah. Well, that's good. No, overall, it's been received really well. And probably one of the top comments I've gotten is how relatable the book is. The people said even if they haven't been in a long-distance relationship or haven't been through the same things, that they can really relate to the book. And that was one of my biggest goals, was that the lessons are relatable. You know, that it's all about overcoming obstacles and using obstacles to uplift your life. And so I was really grateful that is what people are receiving from it.
And I read a couple of the reviews on it, but have you had people reach out to you and tell you how much it's helped them?
I have, yes. And I'm so grateful for them, because I really wanted to hear what people thought of the book. And I think I did have a misperception that, like, the day it's published, I was going to start getting all these comments, and totally forgot how people let books sit on a shelf for a while, or, like, you know, a lot of people do buy books, and it might be months down the line that they read it. So a lot of people who bought it are still telling me, I haven't quite read it yet, but I'm getting there. So I don't know why I thought I was going to get a flood of comments, but that was me, you know, learning. But a couple of people have really reached out. A few have even said, can we get coffee and talk about it? And like, a few people have recently moved, and they told me this is, like, exactly the book I needed to read after a big life shift and change. But my next goal is to try to get it to people in their 20s, or maybe more people right out of college, because I do think that demographic would benefit from the book. And that's probably not who I've targeted yet, but I'm grateful for everyone who's read it.
So how have you targeted people? Like, what kind of marketing have you done? How do you get, because it's like different skill sets, right? Writing a book is one thing, and trying to get it out into the world is an entirely different thing. What have you found that works, and how are you doing it?
Yes. So, I am still running a yoga studio, so my yoga healing center. So that has had to take priority. But because I am the founder of that, that is mainly how I've been marketing is through yoga channels. And so, you know, my students at Soma Yoga have been huge supporters, and I'm so grateful for them. And my teacher at Rasa Yoga in Texas, that entire community has been supporting the book and promoting it. And I've gone around to several yoga studios and done workshops with it. And I have a few more in the works. And then, of course, local speaking events. But it's really been through the yoga channel so far. But someone I used to work with in the engineering world actually has a huge number of followers on Instagram, where she helps young engineers through college. And so I'm partnering with her or reaching out to see if there's some way we could collaborate. So I'm just now starting to think through, like, how do I target that demographic? But so far it's been a lot through yoga channels.
Well, I mean, that sounds like a perfect partnership right there, right? Those are exactly your target audience.
Yeah.
So when you're putting stuff out there, you're doing like a workshop, and that's so interesting, by the way. Like, tell us just a little bit about that workshop. How does that work? You've got the book, you're at a yoga studio, what happens there?
Yeah, so it's definitely unusual, and I am finding that, you know, it's kind of a new idea to do a book event at a yoga studio. But there's a theme, and there's so many themes I could draw from the book. Like, maybe every year I'll do a different workshop and create a new one, because there's a lot of great, you know, practices we could do. But right now I've been focusing on listening to your heart and being able to listen to your heart. And so I'll read a short passage from the book, and then I'll pose a question, like a reflective question for the group. And then we do some gentle movement, like a little bit heart opening movement, meditation, and I have journaling questions and sharing time all around the theme of finding, being able to listen to your heart.
You're not waiting for people to be like downward dog and just sliding the book under them.
Yes, have you bought it?
So I'm curious about your process a little bit. This, you were working full time. So how do you write and work a full-time professional job?
Yes. Writing a lot in your free time. So I did have the good fortune that I was able to start writing this in 2021. And so I had just moved. We moved during COVID. So when I got to Virginia, I had no friends here and barely knew anyone. And it was hard to meet people because it was pre-vaccine. Not a lot of people even leaving their homes. And everything in my life had been wiped away from COVID. And so at least in 2021, I had some extra time after work. And I did just write in the evenings. And I wrote a lot in the evenings. And then it definitely got harder as the years continued, but it was the evenings. Like, I wrote a lot between 9 and 11 p.m.
Did you listen to music, or do you need total silence?
Instrumental music. I prefer it to not have words, but I do like to have instrumental music on, and I like to light a candle. And since I'm a yogi, I did sit on the floor and write. I actually bought myself a desk. It's actually, I think, a tea table. It's meant for tea ceremonies, but I use it as a desk. I sat on the floor and typed on my computer.
That sounds incredibly painful. And so did you give yourself, like, word counts or a certain amount of time every night, or did you just write until you retired?
I wrote as long as I was inspired instead of by word count. So this is actually the most freedom I've ever given myself in a project. Everything I've ever done in my life, I've been really trained in how to do it, or I've had teachers and coaches in it for years. And I never had a writing coach or really any formal training. And so it was the first time I ever set out to do something where I didn't put heavy expectations on myself, or I didn't have a vision of what I needed to do. And that actually really supported me in the book, where if I got a flash of inspiration, I just went and wrote. And if I wasn't inspired, I didn't make myself write. And I put no deadline on it. Like, I didn't say, oh, it has to be done in 2 years, or it's got to be this many pages. Like, I literally went in, like, blank slate, full curiosity. And it was so much fun, because I've always, like, had expectations or feelings of, like, it's got to be this way. And it was a great way to be able to work on it.
I mean, it feels like that would open up your creativity because you're pressuring yourself, but it's also a double-edged sword, right? Because if you're not pressuring yourself, was there ever that moment when you're writing this when you're like, I'm just not going to finish this thing?
after I got like 3/4 of the way through the draft, I was like, I've put enough hours in this that I'm going all the way. Like, I just made a decision that, no matter how long it takes me, I am going to do it. And I did, although I didn't have like a strict deadline on myself, I did say like, I'm going to make sure I at least do something every month. I'm going to stay tethered into it. And not let it just like drift away. And, you know, because I think if you spend too many days without doing work on it, it is really easy for a manuscript to just like go on the back shelf.
That's the most common experience with writers. If they're not working on it every day or every few days, it'll just disappear and they'll never get back to it.
Yes, that was my goal, just stay connected to it. Like not worry about how long it takes, but to make sure I'm staying connected to it and I don't just go a month where I don't do anything on it.
So tell us about your publication process a little bit. So, you know, you can go traditionally published, you can work with a hybrid, or you can go, you know, self-publish. How did you make the decision to publish the way you did?
I researched all the ways, and I read a lot of books on, like, how to publish. I also connected with authors. So I connected with several authors, asked them about their process and how they went about it. And got so much great information on it. And I decided I didn't want to go the way of an agent. And a lot of people told me when they got an agent and pitched to a publisher that it took them 3 to 4 years to really land like a solid publisher. And I thought, this is my very first book. You know, I really just want to publish it. I'm not so concerned about being in like the New York Times, you know, best-selling publisher houses right now. And so I decided I was going to self-publish. That was kind of my thought, like, okay, I'll self-publish this. And then I think the universe honestly dropped me a miracle, if we're being honest. But Instagram said, hey, you might know SoulSpeak Press. And I was like, no, I don't, but I love the name. So I clicked on it. And her very first reel, Jessica Buchanan, who was my publisher, said, are you a woman who's written a memoir who has something to share? We publish woman-written memoirs. And I Googled her, and she just has the most fascinating story, and she lives 7 minutes down the road from me. And my dream was to have an editor where I could work in person, but I thought that would cost a fortune and probably doesn't exist. And we went out to coffee and I got to know her and I was like, hey, if we do this, can we work in person and we don't have to be on Zoom? And it was just like everything I dreamed of a publisher just like felt like it dropped in my lap, and she was amazing to work with.
How much more effective is it to be in person when you're doing edits?
For me, it's more effective. I don't know if that's for everyone, but I just love getting to see like immediate feedback of like what's someone's energy, like getting to see their facial expressions. And I also just was like, I have enough computer work in my life. Like I need, you know, and also we're still on computers, even though we're working together. But to me, it's so much more effective. And I think although I will say Jessica Cannon doesn't need to be in person. She has such a high empathy level. She would get to know all of her authors like at a snap of a button. But she, I think, got to know me really well by being in person, right? Like, because she's helping me edit a memoir. And so I think to be able to just like talk to me and chat more than we would have chatted on Zoom and have that time to really develop a relationship helped her be like, hey, like that part we just talked about is not in the book. Or like, I'm picking up that, you know, this is a quality of yours. We haven't really told the reader about that.
So, I mean, having a good editor is just so valuable, right, in this process. How long did it take for me? Because you mentioned, like, even the arc of the character, what the book's really about, having to change all that. How long, once you handed in a manuscript to her, how long did it take to have a final product?
We worked together a year and a half. However, I did open my business in that time, and so I did push the deadline back a few times. So I think it would have been a year had I not, you know, asked them to push it back. But that was also a sign of, like, a great publishing collaboration for me because they were completely understanding that I had two major projects going on at once and were able to work with me on that as well.
And so, I mean, the 4 years in the making, right, the years of editing here. When it's finally done and you get that box of books sent to your house, what does that feel like when you open it up? Are you actually holding it in your hand?
It didn't feel real. Like, it was like, it took more than that moment for it to sink in. And I didn't come up with the book cover idea till the very end. So, like, the whole time I was like, what is it going to look like? And what's my book cover going to be like? And that was always, like, a really fun curiosity. And I think seeing the actual book cover was like, wow, this is real. There really is a book that's going to be published.
What was your, out of the whole process, the writing or going through the publication, what was the most surprising part of the whole thing?
I mean, you know, people talk about how long it takes and how much effort. And you don't really think of, well, I didn't maybe think enough about how the marketing is like years after, you know, you think so much about getting your book published and then, but really it's there's so much work after it's published. So that was a little bit surprising. I think how much fun it was to work with an editor was surprising to me. I actually really loved that process of having someone bounce ideas off and help you refine your story and dive deeper. And that was a lot of fun.
A good editor is a writer's best friend.
Yes.
All right. I'm gonna go. Does anybody have questions? I can come around with the microphone. Do you have any questions? And she has to answer. She's on video.
While they think of questions, I can tell you one more thing that I don't know if it's surprising about the writing process, but about the whole book process was since publishing, the biggest treat has been people telling me their stories. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we talk about how hard it is to put those vulnerable words on the page. But because of that, so many people have opened up to me about stories they've never told anyone and how they've considered writing memoirs. And that has been absolutely the most rewarding part. Is hearing other stories.
So it's a gift that keeps giving, right? Not only are you helping people, but when they write, they'll help other people and so on.
Yes.
Oh, that's really wonderful. Any questions?
So my question is about when I'm writing something or working on my story, I easily get sidetracked. Like I'm researching something and I'm already deep in that topic. So how do you maintain the focus when writing and not get sidetracked with other things?
That's a great question. I would say, well, the best thing you can do is try to like close, if you're writing on a computer, close everything else out. So to the best of your ability, like only have that document up. I don't know, if you're really get distracted, you can even have apps that like don't let you go to the internet or Instagram. But at the same time, I think to be most creative, I think some of the most creative people do get distracted. And so I think if you can shape those distractions into like, is there something there that relates to my story? Or is there a reason my mind drifted off to that when I'm thinking about this? You might make a connection that you would have never thought about before. So there's like a balance of discipline and this is what I'm doing and I'm going to not let myself get distracted. But I think also artists do kind of float this way and that way and put it all together.
Other questions? Okay, well, I always ask people to just take a moment and if you haven't already, rate her book on Amazon. It makes a really big difference for discoverability and to have somebody else take a chance on it. And if you like what we're doing with Elaine's Literary Salon, please rate us too on like OpenTable or Google or Yelp, wherever you rate restaurants. That would really help. It's a mom and pop restaurant, so we'd appreciate it. It's been really, really lovely. Where should people go to get your book? Besides right here, because you're going to be signing, right?
Yes, okay. Right here.
Where should viewers go?
Viewers can find the physical book on really any online platforms, so Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you get books. If you want the ebook, you can find it on Amazon. And if you're local in Alexandria, Virginia, Soma Yoga Healing Center, Mount Vernon, Cat Cafe, and Holistic Hair Studio all sell it.
Oh, that's great. I love how you're doing that. Well, it's been really lovely. Thank you so much. Congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me.